The Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grade Cricketer podcast on Fox Sports. We've made it. We've made it, everyone. The Ashes, it starts this morning, Thursday morning at the Gabba. We'll be talking today selections, Australia's gift that just keeps on giving. Australian selections, Payne, Marsh, Bancroft, Maxwell, Renshaw, Wade, Neville. It's all happening and we're going to be talking at length about it. Australia feel bullish, though. Australia feel bullish. Lyon says we want to end careers. And Matt Pryor doesn't like that. Looks like Stokes is coming. We're going to be talking about the England team and their tour prep before the first test. The Women's Ashes has wrapped up as well. The Channel 9 commentary team has been selected, I suppose, for lack of a better term. And that's already caused controversy before a ball has been bowled in anger. Tom Morris is on the show. We'll be talking to him about everything that's going to be happening at the Gabba for the next 5 days. And, of course, the biggest news of the week, the Batuta Advocate and Clancy Overall in particular will be joining us. My name is Ian Higgins. I'm joined by Sam Perry and Dave Edwards. And, chaps, let's start straight away with selections. It's Christmas. Christmas has come early for us because this is just a free hit, isn't it?
Yeah. G'day, Higgos. And, again, what a wonderful intro. It feels like we're a little bit late to this, aren't we? Because the last time we went to air was about 24 hours before the wonderful or terrible announcement, depending on what state you're from, of Sean Marsh rejoining the side, Tim Payne, yes. I suppose, rejoining the side in a way, and Cameron Bancroft set to make his debut. So a lot of the news lines have been run and done, but I think we should just quickly dissect it because... You know, an apology from my front. We were talking about the competitors for the number six spot last week and Marsh wasn't even mentioned. So we were nowhere near it.
He wasn't on the radar, Pez. He wasn't even on the radar.
He runs the radar. He's the eternal radar, isn't he? He's eternally on the radar. I suspect he will That's be even point. After he retires.
But, lads, he's got compromat on the Australia selectors, remember? He's got those photos that everyone keeps talking about.
He's got
about.
The photos.
He's got the photos.
He's got a hard
it's a
drive.
Basic low-rent joke, but that's the only reason he's there, isn't he? Photos.
Gents, I think the main reason why he wasn't on our radar, well, certainly my radar, is because he lost his Cricket Australia contract not 3 months ago during the winter months here in Australia. So we thought that was it for Sean. You know, that was the end of his career. It's been a glittering career. I've never seen a batsman who's either he's either zero or 100. I've never noticed that. You know, Sean Marsh typically opens the batting for Australia or has batted three. So six seemed out of the equation. But it was the fact that he doesn't have a contract with Cricket Australia anymore, which signaled to me this was the end. This was it. But nah, next test match, get him back in. Jeez, he looks good.
Oh, mate, he looks so good. He's got a beautiful cover drive and he just looks really, really good. He deserves more chances, if anything. Make him captain, I say. But back to Tim Payne for a moment. I mean, this bloke, he was like a couple of days away from accepting a desk job with Kookaburra or something. He was nearly out. He was nearly out of cricket. Now he's back in. It's a classic example of the bloke that threatens to retire in the hope that someone will urge him to go around again. And it's come off beautifully.
And of course, it didn't help matters with Tim Payne that he did turn up in a Cricket Australia promo, which we highlighted this week in a short-sleeved shirt.
Short-sleeves, please.
How was that allowed to happen? I mean, we've had wonderful relations with Cricket Australia of late as well, but, you know, over a couple of years. But, I mean, to the comms or marketing people out there, how was that allowed to happen? I genuinely want to know when he walked into that studio for that professional shot and how was a short sleeve shirt and wicket-keeping gloves allowed to be on the man's body ahead of his return to cricket? I mean, is he not under enough pressure already?
Heads must roll. I mean, if someone hasn't lost their job over this, then Cricket Australia isn't doing it right. Heads must roll.
So, gents, I'm not sure if you've seen the latest news, which is literally breaking as we speak. The first thing that's ever happened, breaking news on this podcast. But apparently, Sean Marsh is injured and he's hurt his back and Maxwell's in.
Is that confirmed? Is Marsh out? Is that confirmed? He's missing the first
test?
He's
not out, but he's pulled up sore. You know, who would have thought that would happen? He's pulled up sore. Now Maxwell's in. He's not just covering for one player. He's covering for two players. So he might well get a Guernsey this morning at the Gabba. So, geez, it's been an interesting 24 to 48 hours. Or it's been an interesting year, really, in Australian cricket. But the last day or two, especially on social media, it's just been absolute mayhem.
It's hard to keep up with the stories, isn't it? I mean, when we started talking about this a few weeks ago, we were saying it was the phony war and the wheels were in motion, and now it's just turned into a juggernaut. I mean, we were just saying off air that you can't even keep up with the storylines at the moment. Someone says something, there's a reaction, that spawns seven other articles, ex-players are out in force. It's just an absolute festival of opinion.
It's like Trump. It's like the first couple of days after Trump got elected. Every morning I just woke up, like, what is going to happen today? And that's the same thing with Australian cricket right now. I just do not know what's going to happen.
Well, just on that, chap. So Nathan Lyon has come out and he said, when they say they've come out, like, that's just a news cycle thing, but like, who's ever just come out? They just always just seem to come out and say stuff. But Nathan Lyon has come out and he said that he wants to end careers. And geez, I've never known anything which is less offensive to have just wound up an entire nation. Chaps, thoughts on Nathan Lyon saying he wants to end careers?
I don't know. I mean, it's become pantomime, this stuff, hasn't it? I really enjoyed Alastair Cook's response to it. I don't know if you saw it in his presser, but he just laughed and said, I literally just spoke to Nathan Lyon on the boundary. He asked me how my kids were and were they actually just good mates. So I don't know why he's saying this. I do feel like the Australian attempts to, like, wind up England and to play this, like, you know, bully... aggressive role has, I'm not saying it's gone too far in that, like, in a moral sense, but like they're kind of coming on too strong about it now. Like it's almost become comic that they're doing. Like clearly there's an edict from somewhere to wind up England like this. And it's particularly incongruous that Nathan Lyon is the attack dog. If you just look at the rig.
Oh, absolutely. And the fact that he's he's an off-spin bowler indulging in smack talk. It's the ultimate in incongruity. Like, off-spin is the easiest skill in cricket. It's literally just these ones. It's rotating your fingers in a clockwise motion. So I think if this smack talk was coming from anyone else, it wouldn't have copped the column inches that it has. But because it's come from Nathan Lyon, this, like, gangly, friendly guy who asks how kids are going, it just doesn't seem right. And rightly so. A lot of people have been offended by it, no less than Matt Prior, who... He's around. He's someone. He's angry.
Yeah. So Joe Root has actually in his press conference today. He's come out and he said that his England players would never say anything like that. Yeah. Just because, like, why are they getting so offended? Like I'm sorry, but like that is just ridiculous. So anyway, yeah. Let's get back on to Matt Prior now. Who, let's not forget, forgot how to bat last time he was here. I thought Matt Prior was a wonderful wonderful player, but. He forgot how to bat when he was here, and he was offended at the notion that the English batsmen were scared. And it's just like, why can't you say that? Like, you're allowed to be scared when Mitchell Johnson's bowling at the Wacker and he's bowling 150. Like, but like his response to that was just like, no, we weren't. You were scared. Like you're allowed to be scared when a bloke is trying to hit you. Like,
you are allowed to be scared.
He goes, this is great. Do you honestly think that it was a genuine option for Prior and other English players, ex or current, just to admit that they were scared? Like, do you think that would... I think that'd be a wonderful tactic. Like, you know, as a comms manager, perhaps that is the secret third option. To say, just admit you were scared. That's fine. It's a natural human emotion.
I think in hindsight, you're allowed to say it, yeah.
I actually found interesting, just going through the whole social media tirade that, you know, went between Lyon and Prior and a few others got involved off the back of that. But I noticed that someone actually approached Prior saying that Lyon's actually libeled you. So Prior wrote this. He said, last time someone spouted a whole lot of BS about me, I stayed quiet. Not this time. You've embarrassed yourself, Nath Lyon. This game is a funny way of biting back. Some bloke on Twitter called John Cooper QC approached Matt Prior and said, he's actually libeled you. And Matt Pryor's gone, interesting. Would like to hear more on that, John. Thanks. John Cooper goes, interesting. DM me, Matt. I'm experienced in these matters and you have one year from the libel to initiate proceedings. I suggest we begin with formal demand for an unreserved apology. And then I noticed that those tweets were deleted and they obviously went into a private conversation. So I wouldn't be surprised if a few days later we're talking about defamation.
I mean, it'd be the ultimate comeback from an English point of view, wouldn't it?
Yeah, litigation. Yeah, yeah. That's how this.
Well,
all
yeah,
ends.
I mean,
lawyers.
Australia being the like the crass bully, and England coming back with the rule of law and winning.
Yeah, it would be perfect, wouldn't it?
I mean, other words have been spoken. We spoke about this last week. Matthew Hayden has again come out, for lack of a better phrase, and he said some stuff. Stuart McGill is also giving some quotes. I mean, as we said last week, this is just Christmas for ex-players this time. But when after the first ball is bowled, I presume this will all settle down. But let's move on, chaps. As much as I love to speak about the war of words, it looks like Ben Stokes is coming. I was on Instagram the other day. I popped onto Instagram stories, and Stokesy was in there. He was bowling in the nets at his county team at Durham. He was putting new Red Bull stickers on his bat. And the chat is that it looks like he's coming now.
I was really surprised that he was putting his own stickers on his bat. Maybe we'll talk about that for a second. But yeah, it was, I mean, you can't have a story like that, an Instagram story like that, and you would know about this, Higos. You can't have an Instagram story like that and it not be true. You know, I mean, you can't do that and, you know, there's no way you'd see a story like that and then the police come out the next day and say, no, Stokes has actually been charged. I mean, speaking of the rule of law, he's been charged and he's not coming out. Though I know the English journos seem to be holding the line and saying, look, their information is that it's unlikely he's going to tour at all. So I would find his Instagram story with the word grinding splashed across it. Very surprising if he didn't come.
Dave, is Stokes coming?
I mean, I think the series needs him, he goes. It's getting fiery and arky, and there's been so much build-up and hype, but it's absolutely fucking out of control. And I think we need him almost to settle it down, to even the ledger. We've got the alpha approach from the Australians. We've got the considered cerebral, you know, litigation-first approach from England. We need Stokesy in just to kind of get back on track and get the alpha-ness back on both sides. I welcome him.
So what you're saying is that Ben Stokes is acting as some sort of mediator here in some sort of out of court process. Let's talk about the England team for a moment and their tour prep. They finished up a game against a cricket Australia 11. England got 500 and then they managed to take, I think, 3 wickets. Jason Sanger scored 100 in his second ever first class match for the Australia 11. Runs for Root. In the first innings, Cook, couple of runs as well. I mean, like, the tour prep, anything taking your eye there, gents?
No, I don't think we'll remember it. I think this is what I'm worried about going to air right now, because by the time people listen to this, we'll be about 2 hours into the first day or beyond, and everything that we're talking about now will become redundant, including the runs and the words and everything.
Yeah. Okay, let me just say this, though, Pez. I think Alistair Cook is gone. I think I think he will play, but I think his career is on a downward trajectory, and he averages 30 in Ashes cricket. And I know this because Kevin Peterson, his good friend, tweeted this. So in Ashes cricket, of which Alistair Cook has probably played about 4 series, one of which was when he absolutely bossed it here in Australia when England won here, and he scored about 700 runs, him and Trott, we just couldn't get them out. And we tried bowling on his pads, and turns out he's quite good in his pads. So he averages 30 despite having an absolute bumper series. So I think he's gone, and I think he nicks it for fun. That's what I think. So if England are batting right now, when you're listening to this, dear listener, Alistair Cook will be caught behind the wicket. There you go. Unnecessary premonition.
So England won the toss. Have elected to bat, or
Australia's all
I'm really desperate
lunch.
To know. Yeah, well, that, I mean, that was what happened pretty much the last time we played him in a big match.
Good point. Women's Ashes, chaps, has been wrapped up. Australia retained the trophy despite it being a drawn series. England won the last two T20s. Some shocking fielding has got to be said from Australia in the final game. I don't know if you guys caught this, but let's talk about the Ashes series as a whole. I think my personal opinion has been a massive success to run it before the men's Ashes started. What are you guys' thoughts?
Oh, yeah, particularly given we won. I think it's been fantastic, but that's because that's how life is. So if we hadn't won, it would have been an abject failure. No, obviously it's great, and I think that the more exposure people get to women's cricket, the more they realise that these people can play. Yep. You know, Beth Mooney's 100 the other day was just sensational. Yep. What a wonderful player. Mm. She is. And did you see the compilation that Cricket Australia put out recently of both keepers?
Yeah.
Yes, I did
you know,
see
that. In the context of, you know, Payne's recall in short sleeves, Matt Wade, you know, oh God, I don't. The word symbols just came into my head, but that's such a shocking thing to say. But the fact that it came into my head says something, perhaps that I just mince words.
Yeah, it says something.
When you, yeah, that's right. So, but Sarah Taylor and Alyssa Healy's keeping is just fantastic. And I remember, you know, friend of the show, Ed Cowan, coming on recently just saying that Alyssa Healy's an absolute gun of a keeper, and Sarah Taylor's probably a rung above her. So I don't know why I'm going on about keepers so much there, but it was a highlight.
All right. In the interest of time, we'll move along. Dave, I want to ask you about the Channel 9 commentary team, which has been announced. It's really just the same faces as it always is. And there's been some backlash from the public, the paying public for Channel 9, free-to-air television. Channel 9 commentary team.
Oh, mate. Look, I mean, diversity isn't something that Channel 9's known for, although we say that as three white blokes on a podcast together. But Channel 9 is a major television network, as you say. And I imagine they at least have a handful of female viewers that they want to attract, you know, not just to reach that audience, but also to attract, you know, female-skewed brand and advertising opportunities.
Yeah.
Certainly, least of all gender equality. I think the low point for me last year was when Shane Warne started talking about his favourite pizza toppings at serious length. And that was the time that Channel 9's commentary really jumped the shark. But no, they've gone around again with an all-male lineup, same old white faces. So I don't expect much new this time around from Channel 9. But I think when they posted, and they actually posted this photo on social media, that's probably the first time we all saw it. They gloatingly said, look at our commentary lineup for the Ashes series. Yeah. And it was just like a fucking pyramid of white faces, you know, like a Michael Jackson V in the way they were assembled. And surely they would have expected some backlash. Like whoever's tweeted that, it's gone, mate, they're going to realize there's no birds here.
Just like any club barbecue. Sam, I want to ask you, I don't know why I just called you Sam, but Pez, I want to ask you, it seems like these days it's almost too easy to have a bit of a pop at the Channel 9 commentary team, but not a ball has been bowled yet and already they're offside.
Well, it is easy to do it because you know exactly what you're going to get with them. I mean, seriously, is there going to be anything new with the Channel 9 commentators this year? Like, you know that the pizza topping conversation will come up again. You know, it's become so grim for Channel 9 that, like, seriously, Bill Laurie is the best talent on there. I mean, it wasn't too long ago, and I say that with full respect to William Morris, but it wasn't too long ago that, like, Bill Laurie was the joke of the Channel 9 commentary team when it was Richie Beno and Tony Gregg, and they had other guys like Michael Holding and Cozier and those guys on. But now Bill Laurie is kind of like the elder statesman who absolutely gives it to his mates and actually calls the game with a level of like decency and dignity that is sorely lacking in pretty much the rest of them. But we know that this is just about, you know, as Gus Warland, probably not friend of the show as of late, said a few years ago in that famous conversation with Jeff Lemon, that it's just like a sportsman's lunch. And I think the reality is, and maybe a lot of listeners out there to the Great Cricketer podcast agree, they just like sitting down with all ex-Australian captains who each scored, you know, an average of 10,000 test runs. They just like sitting down and listening to their stories and just being in the dressing room with the boys, eh?
Just elbows and jokes.
And as we know, famously, you cannot be a good cricketer and a good bloke. All right, lads, the Ashes starts literally this morning. I fucking cannot wait for it. I hope it's going to be a bumper series. And here's what I want the most of all. Just Sydney to be a live test. Can we just have a fucking live test in Sydney, not a dead rubber? Tom Morris coming up.
We great cricketers work hard. Everything has to be hard at all times. Work hard. Circuit hard. Just be hard. Never smart. Always hard.
Boys, the bloke we've brought on the show today is one of the rising stars of cricket journalism. Yeah, I'm going to say AFL journalism as well. We might talk about that in a second. He's with Fox Sports. His name's Tom Morris. A couple of us know him personally as well. You probably know him from Twitter. He recently has a blue tick, as far as I understand, which I think earned the ire of many of his colleagues, but I'm sure he'll be happy with it. Tom, welcome to the Great Cricketer.
It's a pleasure to be on, boys. And you say recently got the blue tick.
It was actually about a year ago, and I can confirm it was probably the best day of my life. So thanks very much for bringing that up.
How do you get the blue tick?
Yeah, we want one. Blue tick. We never got one.
Well, it's a disgrace that Grey Cricketer doesn't have it, really, but pretty much what happens is Fox Sports send you an email. So your boss sends you an email, and they say, do you want a blue tick? And obviously I was very quick to reply with a yes.
Was that the subject header?
Yes. And then you've got to send forward your address and your email. I don't know what the Grey Cricketer's address is. I mean, there's a bit of Grey Cricketer on all of us, as you said. But then you just, and then about a month later, you just wake up one morning and you're followed by about 80 or 100 Indians and a few Sri Lankans in there as well, and you've got a blue tick, and it's an awesome feeling.
Life is about numbers.
We need more. It's more subcontinental followers. I think we need to tap that market, boys.
Yeah.
Untapped.
Part of the reason we might not have a blue tick is because the Grey Cricketer is not a real person. Nevertheless, Tom, last week we had Izzy Westbury on the show, who put in a staunch defence. In fact, she ran rings around us when talking about the perils of the Australian cricket side and how we're really no great shakes. It got a little bit patriotic, and to be honest, I quite enjoyed it, even though we got destroyed by her. Do you have a view?
She got bodied.
Yeah, bodied. That's right. Tom, do you have a view yourself as a patriotic Australian around and journalist and person close to the game, of course? About how this Ashes series is going to go. I mean, the English are staying quiet and, you know, watching and listening to us be exceptionally bullish about our chances, to the point of just saying we want to end careers and open up scars. It's just getting the military metaphors are out of control. Do you have a view on how this is going to go?
I think Australia's going to win and win easily. I heard what Izzy was saying, and I respect her opinion. I think she knows cricket very well, but I think she's completely misguided in her views on this Australian team and the English team. The Australian team at home is a very good team. People underestimate how good Usman Khawaja is in Australia. People underestimate, they shouldn't underestimate that, but they might not tomorrow, how good the Australian bowling attack is. And also, Stephen Smith is probably the best batsman in the world, along with Virat Kohli, and David Warner's a gun at home. The Australian team is very strong, and they say, oh, what about Sean Marsh? What about Tim Payne? It doesn't really matter if you've got bowlers that can knock people over for nothing. And then you've got a couple of weaker links in the batting order. And let me tell you one thing. And when you've got a weak link, number six or number seven, if the top five makes runs, as I think is going to happen, it doesn't really matter if that guy makes 20 or 30 and not 100 every single time. So I think we're in good shape. I think the English team is a quality. They've got a quality couple, Joe Root and Stuart Broad especially. I think James Anderson might struggle a little bit, except maybe in Adelaide, and Alistair Cook, well, who knows? He's got great runs on the board, but he's not going to take a game away from you. So I think it's a no-brainer. I've tipped Australia 4-0. Could easily be 5-0.
10-0.
So is the one that isn't a result, is that a Sydney washout?
No, it's definitely a Melbourne washout, because you just can't quite predict what the weather's going to be. Adelaide's not going to be a draw with the pink ball. That used to always be the draw test, didn't it? But with the pink ball, it's not going to be a draw. Gabba and Wacker won't be draws. Sydney, well, it depends if they care by then, but that's rarely a draw, because England normally tied by then playing Scott Borthwick types. So Melbourne's the only one left. So if there's going to be a draw, it's going to be in Melbourne.
So right now, as this goes to, as we're recording it, we don't really know the final Australian 11. If Sean Marsh is fit, then he plays. But of course, famously, he is made of salad, and Glenn Maxwell has been brought in.
What hair? Is he made of hair?
He's made of hair. Very finite. No, he scored 100 and broke his thumb and the finger in the West Indies fielding a ball or something. He's always injured, is my point. Anyway, but Glenn Maxwell has been brought in for the controversial selection of Sean Marsh, but what are you hearing about that, Tom?
Well, what I'm hearing is that Sean Marsh, number one, has been selected for a five-test series, having never played five tests in a row in his career. He's only ever played four tests in a row twice. So that's that's ironic in itself. But he's got a sore back. So, of course, he goes into camp after batting for a little bit in a few Shield games and has a sore back, and you only hear about it 24 hours before the toss. And there's an injury cloud over him. So, look, by the time people are listening to this, they might know if he's playing or not. But the fact that he's even under an injury cloud is unbelievable. So Glenn Maxwell's been flown up to Brisbane to potentially replace Sean Marsh. But then David Warner's got a sore neck. So the idea was that Warner might not play, so Marsh would open and Maxwell would go to six. So it's baffling to me that you can fly one all-round cricketer to cover for two players He may as well come up with Malcolm Turnbull as well, because it's just absurd.
grabby line. I just note your particular frustration with the Marsh selection, and I also note that you are Melbourne-based, very much so. I mean, how has the Victorian press in particular taken the axing of Glenn Maxwell, one of their own?
Oh, there's been effigies burned. It's not Sean Marsh's fault. I would have preferred Glenn Maxwell on the team, but I was probably 60-40 that way. I'm not completely against Sean Marsh, not in the way some others are. They four test tons in different conditions, and at his best, he's beautiful. But the very reality that he's never fit for any length of time, and this is partly broken fingers, but it's also soft tissue, means you just can't trust him to stay out there, and then you have to make a change anyway. So I would have gone with Maxwell. The Victorian media has been savage on the selectors, but whatever way the selectors went in this test, they were always going to be criticised and watch the direction and watch the angles. So I don't think they really had a way out. I think they did a reasonable job in selecting an 11. And as I said, you could put any of us four at number six and we wouldn't make any runs, but we'd still win the Ashes 5-0.
So you've actually led me in nicely there, Tom, because I was just doing some research actually about the last time England were here in the 2013-14 Ashes series. And obviously we won that one, we being the Australian cricket team I wasn't playing, but Australia won that 5-0. And I was looking at the first inning scores, and you were just saying before about how it doesn't necessarily matter if Marsh and Payne 6 and 7 aren't scoring runs. But I was having a look at how important Brad Haddin was in the last series. He scored 493 runs at 61. I've written down. So at the Gabba, Australia in the first innings were 5 for 100. Haddin came in and scored 94. Perth, 5 for 143. Haddin scores 55. Melbourne, 5 for 112. Haddin scores 65. Sydney, 5 for 97. Haddin comes in and scores 75. So, like, that's Anderson and Broad again in Australia with a new ball who did some damage against Chris Rogers, Dave Warner, Michael Clarke, Steve Smith, which is maybe a slightly better battering attack, maybe. So I challenge your notion that that England can't take wickets with the new ball. Thoughts?
Yeah, thoughts. Good stats, and you've almost got me, except for one little thing. James Anderson's 35, and he bowls little medium paces now, and he's not getting the zip that he once did.
God, he's going to take 40 wickets now.
Just little meds. So yeah. Johnny Bairstow's up to the stumps.
Well, yeah.
Like, Adam Dale.
I take you back further to the 07 Ashes, and I'll never forget Michael Clarke batting at the Adelaide Oval. He made a ton there, and Matthew Hoggard was bowling, and the keeper came up to the stumps there as well, and that's what I think James Anderson will be here with the older ball. He's not going to be that effective unless the ball's brand new. And yeah, we were five down for not many in 2013-14 and hadn't needed to make runs, but Steve Smith, he's a much better batsman than any of our batsmen were at the time. Dave Warner's a better batsman than he was then. So I think they'll probably cover the slight weak links, which potentially is Cam Bancroft, although I also think he'll be very good because he's a quality player and he's in form.
Comprehensive, Tom. Yeah. High quality analysis. I know that in your personal life, you're a wicket keeper in your own right. You've played some first grade cricket as well. Can you give us a bit of an analysis of Tim Payne as a keeper? I mean, we've been led to believe this week following his selection that although he hasn't made a more recent first-class century than Darren Lehman, that he has, and I read this on Facebook from a Tassie teammate of his, the best mitts in the country. Is that true? Has he got the best mitts in the country?
I think him and Tim... Well, first of all, the term mitts is just crap. I love that. The opposite to mitts is symbols, isn't it? So you've got a bit, it's a symbol to mitts scale, and I think it's heavily weighted towards
the
mitts.
Curvature of the gloves.
Exactly. He's got the cleanest looking keeping technique in the country. I think he's probably the best keeper in the country alongside Tim Ludeman, who's playing club cricket for Geelong now. Great cricket, of course, for Geelong here, but.
But is the cleanliness of his keeping accentuated by the cleanliness of his aesthetic generally? Because he's a very clean, well-kept man who looks good. He's
three
got a good salary,
skin regime.
Discussed at length. And, good skin, good shape.
Absolutely. He's got a nice head, as you said, nice salad. He's got no face salad. He helped. That obviously hurts.
No face salad.
Face salad.
It's getting so weird, the podcast.
That's good, though. He's the best keeper in the country, and I'm glad they've gone with him. What I did look up on today, I looked up his grade stats today, because you may note that Brett G said that he should have a bowl in the first test as Australia's fifth bowler. So I looked him up, and I actually found out through my contacts down in Tassie that 3 years ago in a semi-final in a grade game, he got out Ben Dunk. So if we need someone to take the ball, he'll be the man, and Bancroft and Hanscom can have a keep as well.
Tom, wonderful stuff.
From the selectors, I like it.
I love this idea that when you want to find out about someone, you immediately go to like the to My Cricket. I was lucky enough to talk to friend of the show, Kerry O'Keefe, the other day, and he opened our conversation by saying, Sam, I'm just trying to look you up on My Cricket, because that was the way he was going to get any background on me. Everyone's just numbers. But Tom, thanks very much for joining us. That was fantastic. We'll definitely have you back on throughout the summer. Great to get a more patriotic Aussie perspective, and you know, all the best in all your endeavours, mate, as you cover Australia and their impending 13-0 series win. And also in your own cricket as well.
Nah, no worries at all. Thanks very much, fellas. Great job.
I don't play cricket for results. I don't come to take wickets, score runs, or win games. I play cricket to look good. Rigs, chests, pipes, circuits, salads. This is my domain. So when I hit the sheds, I need to radiate success. That's why I use Chop King Cologne by TGC. With a blend of the finest handcrafted English willow and Kookaburra Red King leather, Chop King Cologne lets me radiate cricket. Whatever the ground, whatever the circuit. Chop King Cologne, the new fragrance for men by TGC. Reek of runs without hitting them.
Boys, a bit of a different one this week, and one that I'm like exceptionally excited about. A bit of an intro here. Defying the worldwide slump in the media, the Batuta Advocate boasts more readers than the New York Times, the Australian, the Washington Post, and the China Daily Post put together. And we've got someone on the line here to talk about that. Hailing from the township of Batuta, which is a ghost town in the far western Queensland desert, Clancy Overall is a passionate regional journalist with over 40 years' experience in the news media. That's not all he does. He's also worked as a ringer, tent boxer, roo shooter, and fencer. He's been known for always keeping a journal on him, documenting life in the Australian outback, whether it was to be published or not. And he joins us on the Grey Cricketer podcast today. G'day, Clancy. Glad you could join us, mate.
Thanks for having me, clubbies.
On that note, Clancy, I was hoping you could just start by telling us a little bit about the cricket scene in Batuta and your experience of it.
Well, mate, it's like, believe it or not, the cricketing community in the Bumton Shire is kind of it's been around. It's one of the oldest codes out this way, and it's so old now, a particular club in Batuta, that it doesn't even have a mascot name, similar to the SCG, refused to kind of carry any form of branding or goofy kind of, you know, titles. There's no sponsors, really, visible sponsors per se. It's all kind of run on membership fees, and it's actually since the Afghan Cameleers kind of brought cricket to the Diamantina Shire, and they they played with obviously that a different brand of cricket that we're used to in the more eastern states, and I guess it carries through today.
So, Clancy, the Batuta Advocate is obviously an institution in Australia now, and I've just gone through the search part of your website to pick out a few cricket headlines because I'm interested in your thoughts. Local dad forced to drop son from backyard cricket side. Brisbane dad takes 7 backyard wickets in frightening return to form. Local dad agrees they just don't make cricketers like Jeff Thompson anymore. A lot of these articles tend to focus on fathers and their sons in the backyard. Was backyard cricket a big part of your own upbringing as a young man growing up in far west Queensland, or not at all?
Oh, no, definitely was, and it is for a lot of people. And it's kind of, and as you guys would imagine, in your entire format is based around just how egalitarian the game is. You know, there's it's kind of like Coca-Cola. You can serve it with any meal, and it's not really class-based as a lot of games in Australia are. It's good at bringing people together, whether they are the snobby cousins from Port Douglas or they are, you know, the scrappers down there in the houses. They all know the game and we all bond over it.
Clancy, I mean, as Dave has just touched on just there, I mean, Batuta's broken some of the world's biggest cricket stories. I mean, not just in the home state of Queensland there, but, you know, some of the world's biggest stories. I mean, I'm just looking here at, Kim Jong-un's fantastic return to form, a blistering return to form for taking 10 for none in North Korean domestic cricket. Of course, Julian Assange, that story there where he sort of took to the window and he asked anybody if they wanted to play indoor cricket. And most recently, of course, Shane Watson's announcement that he was going to coach the French cricket team. I mean, how is Batuta getting all these headlines? I mean, like, where are these leads coming from? Yeah, what are the sources?
Well, we're not really held by the same standards as most sports-based publications are around Australia and around the world. A lot of that particular story on Kim Jong, kind of, you know, believe it or not, we had a bit of trouble with our website for a couple of weeks after that. and the same goes with Assange. You know, he doesn't really like people knowing about his vice, which is, of course, cricket, and he hasn't been allowed to play much of it. And, you know, we get a lot of people looking at our website that you kind of wouldn't have if you kind of abided by the internationally accepted, I guess, book of journalistic ethics.
Of course.
So, you know, I guess these stories are out there for everyone. It's who's willing to publish them, and we kind of, you know, we report without fear or favour in the Simpson Desert.
we were just talking about this recently, Clancy. If we could just move on to the sort of international cricket scene. We were just talking about this earlier, the Channel 9 commentary team. You published a piece, which again was breaking news, that and this might sort of shock people on the morning of the test match as they listen to this, but Usman Khawaja has actually been pressured to retire prematurely in order to diversify Channel 9 commentary, just to add a little bit of pepper to the bench of knowledge. How did you find that story, and will that send shockwaves through Australia given the test is starting today as we go to air?
Well, yeah, as far as I know now, he's declined all offers to essentially ruin his career and work for a failing news organisation, media juggernaut that, you know, probably has about 18 months left, which is Channel 9, of course. I think you can see a bit more future in his cricketing career. But, you know, it is interesting that we've actually just noticed in this day and age of intersectionality among cricket commentary that we just might have kind of only poached talent from captains and high performing cricketers, of course, in the previously nepotistic and cronyistic world of Australian Test cricket. All happened to be young white men who turn into old white men, and that's kind of where we're at. And I think the girls are still too busy. I guess you could consider Australian women's cricket as very much professional now. There is a bit of money getting around, and but they're still working two jobs. At least Perry is playing soccer, last time I heard. So she just wouldn't have time to jump up there and join the likes of Pup, and she probably wouldn't want to.
Clancy, you've obviously reached such a level of fame. Sorry, he goes there. I'll jump in with this one. You've spent time with our own Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, who isn't going so well in the polls at the moment, but he did help launch your new book. You also enjoyed a couple of beers with him. Did you get the sense that he was comfortable drinking beer, or do you think he might have preferred a crisp glass of Pinot Grigio instead? How did you kind of find his beer drinking?
I mean, he seems about as comfortable in that kind of circumstance as he does when he is in the commentary box, commentating. similar kind of
level of uncomfortable,
kind of quite contrived, actually. You know, we had him on Triple M the other day trying to think of an AC/DC song to send off Malcolm Young, and he wasn't able to do that. I think he did play a bit of cricket, but, you know, he, as a prime minister, similar to a journalist and a, you know, social commentator like yourselves, you need to be able to walk in different circles, and quite often Malcolm puts himself in circles that he's not that comfortable walking in, and it shows very quickly.
Clancy, let's touch on the book Batuta's Australia, out right now in all good bookstores. I mean, you touch on sort of linguistics, cuisine, and also these sort of micro demographics within the Batuta community. I mean, for you, what is it to be Australian?
I think anyone who says they are Australian is kind of at a loss of other words to describe themselves. I think there's a lot to holding an Australian citizenship. Apparently, it's pretty hard to just hold one of them. I really excited about current elected officials, but you know, it is a vast country we have, and it's quite a melting pot. And, you know, and that was the aim of that book, actually, to delve into some of the different bubbles out there. I think to just say I'm Australian is selling yourself short a bit, I think, because there's a lot more to it. You might have noticed we went straight. One of the biggest kind of sections there was we were talking about sports in Australia, and just, you know, we had obviously rugby union, the game they play in heaven, as they refer to it. So the game they play in Victoria, and then there was rugby league, the greatest game of all, and followed by that we had cricket, the gentleman's game, and lastly motorsports, the gentleman's shame.
That was actually quite a profound answer about what it means to be Australia. Be Australian, sorry. Clancy, this is one that most people who listen to the show might be able to relate to. You recently reported, Clancy Overall, that is, that a bottle shop employee was considering legally changing his name to Champ. Presumably, he's still working through the technicalities of that, but can you give a bit of an insight into his state of mind as he was thinking about that?
Yeah, no, he was, I mean, it was either that or Chief, I believe, he was tossing up with. And it was just—it was kind of just to smooth things over. But I guess when you are a 19-year-old who's quite visibly hungover, working behind the counter of a bottle shop, you're kind of beholden to anyone, and you're really not—you're not alpha. And I've seen you guys write about this actually. The term champ, whether it's on the pitch or in the cafe or in the bottle shop, it really is a kind of automatic. Kind of knighthood, but not something, you know, it's almost like you're being notched down a few kind of ranks in the hierarchy. And yeah, you know, chief was one he actually had a bit of trouble with, because for him to actually, you know, we start delving into cultural appropriation for him to really live out the chief kind of banner. But champ's pretty easy one to take on, and really, if you don't have any prospects and you're looking at an everlasting gap year as a young bloke in a bottle shop, and you can't really see. I mean, you get a few older blokes working in bottle shops, and they kind of progress to big fella and just mate. When you can get a mate, that's mate. Pretty dignifying. But, I think champ. You know, if you're a little bloke, you're just gonna have to cop that and wear it.
Well, as you know, Clancy, especially in great cricket, it is champ or be champed. I just want to ask you about a report coming out of Monash University, which has revealed that Shane Warne is looking good. And I just want to ask you, if, in your opinion, if this is the first time that you think Shane Warne has been looking good since his new face.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because Shane... It's similar to Matt Dunning, famous former Wallaby, trying to really pull himself together. Pulled himself together after hanging up the boots, hanging up the bat, And yeah, Shane, he is looking good. I think we're all kind of selling him short. I mean, he's looking different, but you know, you see him out there, and he knows as well as anyone. With the sunnies just down his nose a little bit, and the earpiece in, it's really, you know. Yeah. Shane's good at a lot of things, or a few things, and you know, rebranding is one of those things. You know, he's come a long way from the baked beans era. And I think right now where he's at, you know, the Instagram in international seas, drinking cocktails with heaps of straws in it. Shane's looking good.
Clancy, that's all we've got time for the interview today. I think particularly to our UK listeners, this will have been an unmatched insight into the social and cultural sphere of Australia, whatever that is. The Batuta Advocate does have a book out, a hard-hitting coffee table book, I should say, out at the moment. Clancy, thank you very much for joining us and giving us your pearls of wisdom on this podcast today.
Thanks for having me, boys.
Big day? No, big night. I've got to clean up the last two wickets, sing the song, do the covers, sing the song, drink 42 beers in the sheds, have a shower, sing the song, publicly objectify my teammates' rigs, compare sizes, tell everyone how good I was when I was 17, go to a strip club, lie to my wife, then spend all of Sunday being an emotionally absent father and husband. Big nights start with grade cricket. Lying to yourself has never been harder.
Hashtag AskTGC. It is that time of the week again. I hope you listen to this while the cricket's on. And if you're not, I don't know how to finish that sentence. Matt Ellis is going to kick off the show this week. And Matt has three questions. We'll go with one of them. Hi, TGC. I recently picked up your book for a bargain price of $22.95, Australian dollars, I presume, in the recent Click Frenzy sales. I was then drawn to the Books You Might Also Love section that judges your purchase and recommends new titles. It drew me towards Mark Manson's The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, which made me wonder, do you think we are wasting our finite allocated fucks on cricket? Is it good to give a fuck about cricket? And how does this affect your audience if they were to give more or less fucks about cricket? I understand this is a lengthy question, but all my friends hate cricket, so I just really want to know.
Wonderful question, Matt. This reminds me of my time working in the not-for-profit space a few years ago when our CEO said, and it's a very noble idea, that the whole point of, you know, existing is to do so well that you don't need to exist anymore. And I'd like to think the great cricketer is, in many ways, has a not-for-profit spirit. But no, we're open to commercial opportunities if anyone is listening. But in that, essentially, our whole MO is to help people not give a fuck about cricket.
Yeah.
By you know, rationalising why we do. So hopefully, in a few years, people will give such few fucks about cricket that we won't need to exist at all. That's my view.
Yeah, it's a good view, Pez. I haven't read the book, but my partner Julia took the book with her on our recent trip to Hawaii, so naturally the title piqued my interest as we kind of lay there poolside. So I did skim through it, and I had the same thought as Matt, really. And the book does relate directly to cricket, and I did try during my time as a cricketer to give less fucks, but it just didn't work. I tried to care less openly. You know, I started skipping training, turning up late, going out on Friday nights, and turning up with a hangover, hoping that this would help my cricket. But it obviously had the opposite effect. And, you know, I quit my club to join another club. Don't give a fuck. That didn't work either. So I guess in hindsight, I was still giving a fuck, but even though I was going to painful lengths to appear nonchalant. So I would say that since I've quit cricket, I've felt infinitely lighter.
Well, just keep in mind, if you are going to buy one book this summer, make sure it's Mark Manson's The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. But if you are going to buy two books this year, the great cricketer, T, no sympathy. Aiden Beard writes in and he says, I have had trouble facing swinging deliveries the past few years, haven't we all? I feel as if the problem stems from witnessing a man completely naked and wearing a hard hat streak across the field and attempt to jump the stumps, falling and exposing his flapping testicles. I was a 14-year-old wicketkeeper at the time, and I think the experience has scarred me. I had to retire the gloves due to an inability to grab of any type of bouncy ball, and now my batting is being affected. What do I do?
Gosh, this is serious.
Yeah. I was like laughing along a lot until he said he was 14 and there's a picture of a nude man on the field and stuff. But I suppose the cricket angle for me is like, why after that horrific experience is his problem just merely with the swinging ball? I mean, I guess I understand the metaphor, but just from a like a technical point of view, why is it the sort of the shine or the in-swing or whatever? His problem, like he's got no problem sort of with balls at his head or anything. I mean, every time I'm saying balls now, it's
very good against a short ball, but just when it's doing a bit early, he's in trouble. Yeah.
Good question.
Classic fourth grade cricketer. If it's full, you'll drive. If it's short, you'll pull. If it's anywhere in between, you're absolutely fucked. This one is a private message, which I think is probably the question of the week. It comes in and says, "Hi, guys. I work at a university in Sydney. I'm breaching privacy laws, so I can't identify which one, and I'd prefer if you didn't use my name. I imagine most vice chancellors listen to this. A student recently applied to reschedule an exam that was on Saturday, as they were aiming for selection in a first grade Shires team, which would set up selection in a Frank Gray Shield, whatever the fuck that is, and their career more generally. As a former grade cricketer, should I reject his request as his playing future is essentially over, he's playing Shires, and force him to sit the exam as scheduled, in punishment for his outlandish views on the hierarchy of grade cricket in Sydney?"
Very good. Very well written as well. That is a university-educated listener.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, it's a straight answer. That's a yes, and for all the reasons that Private Man has already outlined.
He knows
outlined.
The answer. Yeah, he knows the answer there.
What bad luck for the person who applied to change the exam that they went straight to a grade cricketer.
Did you ever have to reschedule exams to fit around grade cricket? Because I remember that happened a couple of times for me, and I was always approved. And rightly so. I think, obviously, grade cricket is above Shires, and Shires cricketers should have to sit all exams because they're never going to make it as professional cricketers, and they should be focusing on their studies.
There's a real war on Shires cricket on this show, isn't there? As there should be.
It's turf war.
Perhaps we should get someone to try it. Perhaps we should get someone from Shires cricket to try and come on and defend the code. If there's anyone out there who wants to join, let us know.
So first grade Shires, so this guy's aiming for selection in first. So he's playing second grade Shires, and if he gets into first grade, he's going to get into Frank Gray Shield. And Frank Gray Shield,
he's going to set up his career more generally is the bit that interested me.
Yeah, but the Frank Gray Shield is an under-24s competition. So like in Sydney, they have the Point of Grey, which is under-21, but Shires is under-24, just in case you wanted to escape cricket more. They make you play Saturday, Sunday until you're 24 in Shires. You know what? I think we've already answered this question.
This is good because we're starting to pick holes in this question as well. Like, has this bloke literally written to the university and said, "I need to play because I need selection in first grade"? So he's like, literally, he's outlined where, what grade he's currently in, how he's going, that if he makes first grade, he then will qualify for an under 24 comp. I mean, it's very elaborate way of getting out of an exam.
Pretty sure there's not that much space in the application box as well. Like, he probably would have had to like attach an addendum to outline how this will set up his career more generally.
I think the only way he can get away with this, if he's hoping to get into first grade to then play under 24s, to then transfer to a grade club because he has played first grade Shires. That's the only way I can see him in getting out of this. Next question. George Taylor says, "Hi, gents. I'm considered one of the best looking blokes at my club and have a decent rig, chest and pipes, three times a week in the gym. I feel like I'm well respected amongst the other players, having held down an opening spot in the twos over the last few years, averaging 20 odd. I am also working my way onto the committee to take more of an active role in club life. So why don't girls like me?" Good question, George. And the answer is obvious, I feel. Dave?
Oh, the whole question reeks of insecurity. He goes, that's all I need to say there.
Yeah, I just wonder, George, whether you believe that what you've said above is somehow attractive to women, because it's not. I mean, I suppose chest and pipes three times a week is, but after that, playing in second grade and in doing so, opening the batting, trust me, having been there, and then working your way onto the committee. I mean, I don't know if you believe that to be some kind of like, you know, like political masterclass of yours. Literally no one else wants to do it, I can assure you. You'll be given every opportunity to do it. How you think that leads to women liking you is beyond me.
He has ticked a lot of boxes here, though, I will say, because he's obviously lied about playing twos for a number of years and averaging 20-odd. He obviously averages 14 and has played three games in twos. But then why would you want to be on a committee? Is there anything less That's like human contraception, being on a cricket club committee. So that's why girls don't like you, George. But thanks for your question. Pez, this one's directed straight at you. Stephen White on the Twitter machine writes in and says, does Pez want to grab a pint with an Aussie in London to watch the Ashes?
Sure.
Okay.
What do we do now? Yeah.
Any strangers from the internet who want to catch up with any of us, always welcome to get unsolicited answers from strangers on the internet.
Please.
Thomas Moore writes in and says, did Beth Mooney just play the perfect game of cricket? 100 in a losing side, he's referring to.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Especially as the country has been craving opening batsmen in any gender of cricket. Well done, Beth Mooney. It was a great innings too.
All right. Olympics has said this in response to the 9 commentary teams.
Olympics.
Not one rig-based selection here. 0 pipes, 0 levers, although worn circuit ability is second to none. My guess is you would get 0 sets of gloves out of this lineup.
Yeah. It's funny, actually, because when I first read this question in response to the unveiling of the 9 commentary team, I thought, well, how could you have a row of test captains and other luminaries without pipes and levers? It's completely contradictory to the whole policy of Australian cricket. Mm-hmm. These are the leading lights of Australian cricket. And then I looked through it, and it's actually kind of true. There aren't many pipes and levers
Clark
and all that have
levers.
Been. I mean, Ian Chappell.
Clark has levers.
Well, you would have thought Bill Laurie had levers too, because he's very tall, but he didn't play with levers.
No levers.
If that makes sense.
Richie Benno had
Ian Chappell,
salad.
I'd say, in his... You better add salad. Chappell in his day would have had pipes, but who else has pipes and levers? It's definitely not Mark Nicholas.
Tom Moody.
Definitely not Shane Warne, apart from a small era that coincided with a failed drug test. But yeah.
All right, this next one is nameless, but it says, dear TGC, will you be releasing a Duke-scented fragrance for the English fans? Also, after your predictions for the Australian selection, can you please make more predictions about the result of the first test from an Englishman? Hashtag ask TGC. I feel like we've already done that. Paddy Putty writes in. He says, why was I so heartbroken / disappointed to find out Sam Perry was bald? I'd always pictured him with hair.
I remember when I first came across a young Sam Perry with hair, probably the first time, probably about 12 or 13 years ago, and it was magnificently spiky. A lot of product, as was the style at the time. So I do recall, even though it's a faint memory now, it's a fond one of Sam Perry with hair. So it did happen.
It's a fond memory for me too, don't get me wrong. I just want to say one or two things about this question. I'm a bit miffed at someone I don't know feels heartbreak over me being bald. Trust me, the feelings are mutual. I also feel heartbreak every day about it. Now, I'll just tell a quick story. About 10 years ago, around the time Dave's talking about, I was at training, probably with you, Dave, and there was a guy at our club. I won't say his nickname because it might muddy the waters of other things, but his name was and still is Sean. And I remember he was nude on top of his head. His head was naked, and it was like alarmingly so because he's very fair skinned. Anyway, as with anyone who's bald, it becomes a defining physical characteristic. I've learnt that, and I remember mocking him about it. And he turned to me and he said, "Be careful, mate. It can go very quickly." And
prophetic.
A year later, I had no hair in my head, and I think Sean Nugsy put a curse on me that day, and I paid for that comment.
That sledge was literally one brings two. That's literally what he was saying to you.
Yeah.
That's very
all right,
good.
Sam, speaking of hair, thanks, Sam buddy. Ty writes in, and he said, is the to-be-confirmed selection of Tim Payne final proof that we've moved away from the rig-based selection towards new-age salad-based selection? Additionally, is this comment on current culture and the rise of metrosexuality in a broader sense? Finally, what does this mean for grade cricketers sculpting rigs, only to be potentially ousted by the whippy left-armer with a fresh fade, or is grade cricket immune to the tides of change?
Well, that's a fantastic question, Sam, and I think you are definitely onto something. Firstly, I just love saying salad, but look at Chris Lynn.
Yeah.
You know, early, like mid this year, Chris Lynn was in the Australian Champions Trophy team. I didn't recognise him. I was lucky enough to be there at Edgbaston as Australia played England. Lynn came out to the field. I'm like, who is that? And it was Chris Lynn, bald. What's happened to Chris Lynn now? Retired from first-class cricket, lost his Cricket Australia contract. doing the IPL
dead
rounds.
To selectors.
No salad.
Yep, no salad.
Coincidence?
Coincidence, I think not. I think it's a definite correlation there. Salad selections, it is a thing. Usually the salad and the rig come together, though. Like, it's, I mean, why have one without the other? It's like having a sleeve tattoo but terrible pipes. Chicken and the egg, really.
Yeah, if Stokes didn't have pipes, it would be very incongruous, wouldn't it? All right, lads, last one for the week. Elliot Bird writes in. It's a bit of a long one, but stick with me on this one. Hi, grade cricketer. My last game of grade cricket was a second grade grand final a few years ago, which suffered from a scheduling conflict with a stag weekend. Being down a few players, I extended the invitation to play to my 51-year-old dad, a former grade cricketer of note. I was excited at the prospect of playing a grand final with my old man. However, this excitement soon turned to abject depression. As an opening batsman, I was involved in an early mix-up where I sent the non-striker, our best batsman, down the river, attempting a suicide single, which resulted in him being run out about 3 metres short. After this early stutter, I managed to keep my composure and score a free-flowing 30-odd, actually 18. Dad ended up top-scoring with 45 not out, red ink. Going out to defend a subpar score of 177 was never going to be an easy task. However, after our opening bowlers snared a few cheap wickets, we started to get our tails up and think that we may be a chance. With the game evenly poised at 6 for 100, I decided to keep up to the stumps to our second change medium pacer, and two balls later managed to effect a leg side stumping, the likes of which I will never be able to repeat. While the whole team engulfed me in the celebration, I noticed Dad down the other end engaging in a casual chat about capital gains tax with the umpire, who was of similar age to him. He didn't acknowledge my superb dismissal at all. Alfred. He even chipped in with a couple of miserly overs of slow mediums going for absolutely bugger all, which in my opinion was completely fucked because he was bowling the type of shit I dispatched with glee where we were playing in the backyard at home. Before too long, we had them 9 down requiring 20 runs to win. Fucking, I've bought into this story. Things started to get tense as their last pair eked out some excruciatingly yuck singles. Then came the breakthrough. One of them ran the ball down to third man, where Dad happened to be stationed. As I set off for a second, I screamed, "Keepers, keepers!" Despite my desperate plea, he wound up his middle-aged levers, admittedly still impressive, and cannoned it straight to the bowler's end, Alfred again. It was a direct hit, and the batsman was short. Chaos ensued. We'd won the unwinnable. Whilst I know I should have been jubilant that I'd been part of a winning grade final and shared the moment with him, I couldn't escape the feeling that I would have rather played the game without him and subsequently lost than find myself in the quagmire I did at the time, in which he had more social capital than me during the game after match beers. He even came out on the circuit and bought numerous rounds for the boys. Lads, it's been years since that day, and I haven't played serious cricket since. My question is, how do I get him to shut up about it? He's been dining out on the story for 7 years. I'm seriously dreading going home for Christmas. Hashtag ask TJC. Fuck me, that's the best question I've ever seen. Elliot, well played.
TGC short stories. I think it's a new segment. I don't really know what to add to that.
No, I think it should stand on itself, I think. That was beautiful.
It's logically reacted with emotional logic to what has happened, and I don't think you should play cricket again, and I don't think you're going to shut your dad up about it.
No. Middle-aged levers, admittedly still impressive.
This is the name of the next book.
Definitely on his dad's LinkedIn. All right, guys, it's been a wonderful show. Thank you so much for Clancy for coming on. Tom Morris as well. The first test has started. You can engage with us on social media as ever, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You know the score. TNO Sympathy out in bookstores right now. I hope you're enjoying the cricket. See you next week.